This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The whole idea was to have a conversation and not to just hear us present. So there are two ideas I'm going to present here, which sort of may become a point of departure. That's embodied energy and embodied water. And I'm going to sort of bring into presence two. One was a workshop, which was just a week long, and the other one was actually a studio, which we did at Penn here. And just we were invited to Berlin, to the Bauhaus, actually to do a workshop on large-scale energy landscapes. And for Dilip and me, what was really interesting was that rather than thinking territorially about extension, we thought that we have to think of not extensive energy, but intensive energy. And that really brings out the whole idea of embodied energy that I want to talk about. So we began with a film, actually. And, you know, we were at the Bauhaus, which was in the Mohini Nagi Studios, which was appropriate. It was all about time and movement. And we actually began with a particular film, a YouTube film, of a journey from the northwest of India through the desert all the way into New Delhi. And what it actually crossed was, it crossed amazing number of communities which are right up close to the railway line. And so we said, if we have to think about energy, we have to really take the Indian railways and the right of ways and think of energy completely differently, not as, you know, consumers and producers or those kinds of, you know, separations, or there's large-scale territorial appropriations in the world and small-scale. So what you're seeing scrolling down is just a week in which each student actually drew that film initially, but then started to bring in a lot of other dialogues. So, for example, that what you're seeing right now is one particular group which talked about the intimacy of the train itself, which creates its own energy in terms of community. But in the silence between every station, there are many agents in the landscape. So rather than thinking of ecology, infrastructure, community separately, some of these explorations started to bring all the agents, the birds, the monkeys, the old man, all these quiet agents which work, and where is the place for them? But this particular exploration also started to take us beyond cities or boundaries between urban, rural, and how the infrastructure of trains can actually become the starting point of a whole culture of reservoirs or tanks, which are part of the Deccan. So what you're really seeing is that we began with one particular film, but we were able to appropriate many. And to some extent, we are sort of site, non-site, because we're sitting in Berlin with a group of international students and trying to understand something about energy. Now, what's important about this image you're seeing is that when you saw the film, one student picked up every point of water. There were water supply, there were clothes drying, there were people doing things. This is all on the railway tracks. So for us, the whole idea that energy in India is not about something out there, but it's embodied in the practices of people, became a very important idea. And how can we take that, work with that, but also extend and amplify it? So while it is a commodity, we can actually break down the barrier between who produces and who consumes. And so if you start thinking that so many of these settlements, millions of people who live there, each one becomes an agent in transforming how they use water, how they use their rooftop, it actually has a kind of rhizomatic effect. So it's not about large corporations, large people working. So this particular one, which actually dealt with water in many ways, became, you know, an interesting one. But what was also important, that you can look at the same film, but even we as a community of designers can actually find another lens by which we can see. So how do you bring complexity to the way we look at it? So using the film, using the media of actually time, where somebody was just looking at day and light, we have the sun in India. How can you use the sun in the day and power up everything else in the night? But also there is a real landscape and there's the surreal landscape or the stylized landscape of Bollywood through which we think about trains and journeys. And so, again, what you're looking at is that, you know, you may start off by just thinking of literal right-of-ways, but by finding this way of working, students were starting to bring in sequences from, you know, other films, other landscapes, and starting to think that there are so many components that it's not only the railway track, rights of ways, stations, and in a country where there are so many people, that's not a problem, that becomes an asset. You know, how do you actually generate energy? Because they are there and they can be part of that production. And so this whole notion of embodied energy really built on what we said, the cumulative impact of a number of small initiatives rather than singular ones. But I think what's the most important, you know, and you can barely read this, is to encourage energy that is integral to the embodied practices and processes of everyday life. And and you know, one might think that that is just what you see around and that one is actually stylizing or glamorizing a way of life. But within that, there is so much potential, actually. And so the whole notion of embodiment, we realized, was something which was very much part of the way we've looked at water in a lot of our other work. And when I say us, I'm talking about Dilip and myself. But in this particular thing, you know, from extensive, where we say production, consumption, global, local, space-time, that sounds a little funny, you know, presumption, glocal, you all have heard, and even spine. We privilege time over space, actually. And so many of these practices deal with time as much as space. But just to briefly touch on another issue which became very interesting for us, and there are many students who've participated in the studio, that how do we look at places which are so caught up and separated by boundaries, whether you're looking at watersheds, lines of rivers, or whether you're looking at walls which separate territories? And how do we, through our own travels, actually have to at times build another structure, another infrastructure through which we have to start to work? So the whole issue of observing, drawing, splicing, but using another ground in which we actually start to think of our interventions has been a very important part of our work. Here's, you know, Abigail and Ming Yang, who's, you know, were working in Jerusalem. And the whole surface of that landscape from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea really became important. Or Graham, who's sitting here, who opened a beautiful idea about how can you plug off and plug on to infrastructure. So there was a sense of being isolated and being able to disconnect and yet connect. And, you know, I'm just going through to give you an impressionistic sense of really finding ways to even think about ourselves as a designer. This was an amazing idea. Actually, 25% of the world's birds fly through the Kidron Valley, which is the valley we were looking at it. And how do you look at things like sewage, water, and birds that know no boundaries to actually start to provoke the conversation? And so while we are doing this in the studio, opening our imagination, we found a very interesting situation where the mayor of Obadiah, who actually is the guy sitting, Mr. Suleiman, right in the middle, is actually saying that I'm going to take the sewage of Jerusalem and actually convert it into water and, you know, become the good guy. And he was one of the few leaders invited to the Arab League. He and the mayor of Cairo were the only two. But what's fascinating is that the moment they start to think about even sewage as a commodity, it actually becomes something which is contested. So when we actually started to talk to them and have been continuing this conversation beyond the studio, is this whole idea of embodied water. Can the water they clean and work with be part embodied in the landscape? And suddenly the same kind of thing as to who has the plant, who owns the lot, where is the water going, and even sewage water is actually quite contested because it's going to the date palm groves which are being used by the Israeli cultivators. So we found that this whole notion of embodying it into practices has become a fantastic way in which we don't divide institutions, communities, as well as ecologies. I have one more slide I want to advance because, and this was speed talk, and I'm hoping that when we sit down, we can actually flesh this idea a little more. But I come onto the table because Teddy and I have had, you know, many conversations, and I have one slide. Okay. You know, where this is another kind of crossing, and I know that Teddy's going to talk about it, but that's the border between Tijuana and, between San Diego and Tijuana. And here's the estuary. And it's not only, you know, territories where we are dividing lines which are sort of ephemeral, but this is a firm line. And we participated in this crossing where he made us actually go through the culvert where sewage comes in from Tijuana into America. And we, I think there were about 155 Americans or different nationalities with all these different passports who actually, Well, anyway, that went. And so maybe somewhere that crossing, which was between this hard boundary and the crossing of these ephemeral materials, could be something we can talk about. So thank you very much. Yeah. Right.
It was really beautiful to hear you talk about your work. I'm trained in a very different set of disciplines, and I think that's, you know, that's what this school and this university really embody for me. I'm trained in social work, in social welfare, and in city planning. And great. And the lenses that through which I look are primarily spatial, and in reading landscapes, and my main tool are maps and geographic information systems. And sort of my quest is to understand the city. And I think, something brought us all here or to the other cities that we love. And I think that, tremendous opportunities, whether they're educational or cultural. But cities are also a great statement about disparity and how it really shapes so much of our world here in this country and around the world. Probably not a big surprise to you guys, but recently we learned that 28.4% of people in Philadelphia are living in poverty, and that's 40% of our kids. I mean, that's atrocious, and that's 46 million people across the United States. Has anybody heard either presidential candidate talk about the 46 million people who are living in poverty? Probably not. And I think that one thing that I'm excited about this Mixed Place project, which we'll talk more about, is zooming in on these issues of disparity. And the linear mile has become one metaphor that we've understood those, but only one. So I want to just talk a little bit about how I see cities and the lens that I look at, so through maps. But having the privilege of using these tools and being in a great institution like this and having a great forum like this, I can, I have the opportunity to sort of layer meanings and show. Whoop, I didn't do that right. Okay, great. In terms of understanding the many meanings of our city that it can use with GIS. So W.E.B. Du Bois came here 100 years ago and did a study of our, what was then, and we understand now is downtown, but was then called the Seventh Ward. And it was the heart of Black Philadelphia. So part of my sort of scholarly work and outreach and education with high school kids is teaching about this history, holding up the fact that there were these major Black institutions, some of which are still there, some of which have become condominiums, and to help tell the story about the highway that was never built but did still cause significant displacement, and about gentrification. And not to make that a simple conversation or this is good or this is bad, but to engage in that conversation. That's one of the conversations we've had with you through our Mixed Place project. Another form of line of scholarship that I've been interested in is talking about redlining. So if we want to understand the nature of the disparities that we see today and the conditions that we see and how different our university city, our neighborhood around here is to some of our neighboring neighborhoods, understanding the history of access to mortgage lending. And insurance is part of that. So this is the map of the Homeowners Loan Corporation from 1934. And, of course, the federal government didn't have Google Earth back then, but still had the same very similar mapping technology and thought about access to capital and lending through a spatial lens. And the areas that were shaded red were considered hazardous for real estate investment. People all across the country were involved in making maps like this to assess sort of the viability of neighborhoods. And I think that the ways that people do that now to talk about sort of what's a good neighborhood or a bad neighborhood or what's viable or what's not may be a little bit more subtle. So I think, in some ways I respect that in 1937, the agents of the federal government had no shame in just saying there's some areas that we want to invest in and others that don't. So part of my scholarship and my teaching is about revealing these meanings and thinking about the many layers of meaning in the city. So you can't really see that too well, but that's thinking sort of from a almost a global perspective, looking down at the city like a bird. But we know now we have all these tools to sort of walk down the street and see them. And one of the main parts about Mixed Place is how do we engage a whole new set of people, a whole new set of agents or actors, as Anu was talking about, whose everyday lives and practices are very much what we study here in the School of Design. And I have had the chance to introduce some kids to Street View and sort of see the neighborhood that they get to see. And and I think the question is what do we get when we start to include new people in this conversation about the city and the meanings meanings and the many layers of meaning. And I think that what we'll see is, you know, that we're all doing this in our day-to-day lives as walking through the streets and reading the landscape. And I think if we ask the youth sort of what are the meanings that you ascribe to some of the stuff, that rather than some of the graffiti that we see, that, you know, that sort of these kids in their own ways are screaming that we deserve better. So how do we see that these youth who are around our city who know they deserve better have an opportunity to become architects or planners? We've had some pretty inspiring youth who've been part of this Mixed Place project. So when I look at this, I don't know what you see. I see cigarette ads. Makes me mad. Mad as a mom. Mad as a health advocate. Mad at the tobacco industry. You know, that's my lens. What happens if we start to include more people at the table? This is a vision Adjoa and Levon, who've both been part of our Mixed Place project this summer. They didn't imagine necessarily a skate park at the corner store, but they said, hey, you know, what about a skate park? How do we engage people in a conversation about the meaning of that and something that we could do with youth? We've had some other youth, Lynette and Javon, who were talking about, you know, why do we have all these vacant lots and how could we transform them into community gardens? And those are the kind of visions that we have a whole new set of characters around the table that we can start to engage with them in some, I think, some pretty special ways. Just wanted to end by talking about a different group of youth who I had the privilege of working with. I mean, what would it look like if every day we saw youth, teenagers here in the School of Design? You know, we've got a pretty cool group here tonight. This is actually taken in B3 downstairs, which a lot of you guys know. It was a day when a group of kids from West Philadelphia High School came and gave a presentation. And they had a rapt audience for 30 people that just were just dying to know what these kids said. And so we gave them the tools of, you know, we taught them about ethnography and survey methods. You know, and the question they had is, what's going on in the hallways at our school? You might think, you know, hallways at your school. I mean, where it's happening in a high school, the hallways of the school. I mean, you know, sex, drugs, socialization, all kinds of negotiation. I mean, that was we talked to them about the corner, the book The Corner, and these interstitial spaces, and this is what they decided they wanted to study about. Nobody else on this planet is going to come up with the idea that we should be studying, I think, the hallways of high schools to really understand the experience of youth. And yet these guys were the ones who came up with that. A couple years after, some of these kids came and worked for me one summer. They were really hungry to be part of the university for a job, part of the research operation. Like I could ever forget these guys, a year and a half later, I got a letter that I'm just going to read and close with from one of them. It said, "Dear Dr. Hillier, hi, I'm Mateen from West Philadelphia High School, and we're trying to get to the bottom of redlining. I'm not sure you remember me or not, but we used to work together surveying people about parks during the summer. We're trying to get to the bottom of redlining in West Philadelphia community. We want to try to solve this problem because we believe it's highly disgraceful towards our other ethnic groups." And sort of my bottom line is, when we open the doors, whether it's this institution, the university, I just came back from a major planning conference where they're lamenting the same thing that we were lamenting here 2 weeks ago. How do we get more people of color? How do we get people from disadvantaged socioeconomic conditions? How do we get them into our design professions so that they can hold up these visions, these ideas, these dreams? And so that the T-shirt that I'm wearing, I am in the back, it says Diverse Design, and just a shout out to the Diverse Design group here in the school that I think is really trying to be at the forefront of this conversation about what does it mean when we bring a whole new set of people into our conversation.
All right, I will try to be as efficient with the time, but I'm from Latin America, so I cannot promise anything that I cannot blame that anymore. Anyway, let's see. I hope the slides change. Of course, we are going to have time to elaborate on these issues during the discussion. That's the primary thing, to have a conversation. But I couldn't help beginning by just meditating on a series of inspirations that really have inspired also the project here at Mixed Place. And of course, speaking as an architect and a professor, I have been meditating on the possibility of expanding our notions of practice, particularly within the institution and protocols, that really have perpetuated particular approaches, let's say, to many of the issues that have been discussed so far. So I'm interested in the expanding of the notions of design. What else can be designed, in a sense? And very much interested in opening up the possibility of designing protocols. We'll get to that in a moment in the context of the pedagogical process that we've been designing in combination with many of these agencies. I could not help beginning without really understanding, of course, that we are occupying a very specific juncture in the history, not only of this country, but of humanity. What is the crisis? What were the conditions that produced the crisis in the first place? The conditions that produced the crisis in the first place become the material for the designer today. And recently I found this sort of a statistical graph that it became fundamental in my understanding of the crisis. I've been interested in processes that enable the visualization of conflict, the visualization of crisis, and this one for me was essential in really framing many of the issues that we are discussing today. Two lines that move across time, that bend and stretch across time, probably from the late 1920s to 2006, you see two peaks at the end of this graph, on top and on bottom. This graph ultimately, in my eyes, really puts to rest what you have been hearing for months or years already, that this is the worst economic recession since the Great Depression. Why? Because at those two moments in history, in 1926 and 2006, we have in front of us the largest income inequality, the largest gap, the socioeconomic gap in this country, but it's also paired by mirroring that line below, which at those two moments, we find the lowest taxation on the wealthy. So for me, this really puts to rest, again, as I was saying, and really the conditions that produce the crisis. But what is evident also is that while we have been focusing our conversation on those two moments, we never talk about the valleys between those two peaks. And I began to meditate about the nature of that period in the history of this country, primarily because it is around this area, after beginning, let's say, in the early 30s to the beginning of the or the end of 1970s, where we have a more equitable, let's say for a moment, redistribution of resources. The alliances and synergies across philanthropic spheres of this country, civil society and government are seeking a way of reformulating or reconfiguring or restoring some kind of responsibility or accountability. The Bill of Rights is presented by early 30s by FDR, as we all know. The New Deal emerges, which really speaks of an unprecedented investment in public infrastructure, public housing, in fact, public parks, public health. The word public was not forbidden from our political language in a way. And I will not meditate also on the fact that during this period there are many problems that emerge because the top-down public then was not informed by probably the complexity of our thinking today. But nevertheless, during this area, during this period, it is evident that we were really seeking some level of collective imagination. So I wanted to begin by really opening up that question. Where is our collective imagination today that can ultimately intervene in the gap that has existed, I think, as part of our crisis between urban policy and public participation particularly. This suggests that this is not only an environmental crisis, an economic crisis, but particularly a cultural crisis, a crisis of the institutions that are unable to rethink their own protocols, a crisis ultimately of knowledge, but of knowledge transfer between the top-down institutions and the bottom-up intelligence, I think, of many communities across the world. This has been the lesson in Latin America from the 70s, the participatory budgets of Porto Alegre that really opened up the municipal budgets of that city to a collective and kind of public participation to redistribute the resources, or the lessons of Curitiba as well, or Bogota that really found itself transforming infrastructural ideas based on an urban pedagogical model of inclusion, and that maybe ends in Medellin with the library parks, where the mayor of Medellin suggests that public space is not just a manicured environment, but really needs to be plugged with knowledge. So this gap between institutions and communities has been really part of the conversation, not only in my own research, but really with the project we've been engaged in here, understanding, in fact, that marginal neighborhoods could be sites, or are in fact sites, of socioeconomic and cultural production. As we were amplifying the value of the global city in Dubai or China years ago of glamorous economy, not one single idea was advanced in those environments that really could take us out or rethink really these institutions in also reimagining infrastructure and beyond. While in fact in marginal neighborhoods we found out of conditions of socioeconomic emergency, very interesting procedures. So how do we move from the neighborhood to reimagining regions, this moving and oscillating simultaneously across small and large, across different scales has been important. And it's interesting that Anu showed those images, which I have to borrow from you because your image, that documentation is really wonderful. But these are the two marginal neighborhoods that I've been working with during the last 12 years in San Diego, at the junction between Tijuana and San Diego. To the north, the small neighborhood of San Isidro, and to the south, you see the Canyon of Los Laureles, which is a shanty town that houses 85,000 people, and you see faintly the border between San Diego and Tijuana. A part of the argument has been, can we reimagine the region out of a kind of neighborhood-based urbanization, understanding the specificity of the political and the socioeconomic relations embedded in these forgotten communities. Last June, in fact, I curated this sort of process of expanding, again, the nature of my practice. I've been wanting to enter into the curatorial aspect of projects where conversations are reorganized, and I decided to produce a project that would link these two communities that are separated by the border but very close to each other. And I proposed a crossing, an alternative crossing of the border, not through the official port of entry, but convince Homeland Security to let us transform a drain that separates. Recently, Homeland Security built a new wall separating these two environments, separating a Tijuana an estuary, which is called the Tijuana River Estuary, from this shanty town that I showed you. So this sort of occupying of this very important geography of conflict between the slum and the estuary, we convinced Homeland Security to let us transform the drain into an official port of entry from the United States into Mexico for 24 hours, and that's where Anu came and Aaron Levy co-curated this in many ways with me as well. Because now that Homeland Security has built this wall, it has accelerated the flow of sediment of and trash from the slum into the estuary, contaminating it. So this sort of idiocy, how would you call it, of institutions that think that because for the sake of security we're going to build walls, but ultimately that very attitude is undermining our own security because that wall is going to eventually produce socioeconomic degradation and so on. So this is where the Political Equator 3 event took place. We put a tent in the midst of this environment as a Trojan horse because we disguised it as an art performance. This is where it helps to teach in the visual arts department at UCSD. And we produce models and visualizations and conversations, and this is where we began to then cross the 150-some people towards the slum. And it is this condition of, and this is just a very quick... video for to show you the drama of this of the crossing. But what became interesting was the process, of course, of getting this permission that enabled the bringing of the public, the bringing of the conversation to the very sites of conflict. It was important to be in a kind of embodied way present within those conditions of crisis, understanding and visualizing where these ecologies collide between the slum, the environmental zone, the militarized zone, and so on, and to really expose them because nobody really understands how these collisions occur. I thought this would be going even faster, but the idea was to summon activists, scholars, artists, politicians. The former mayor of Medellin came to cross with us because he gave a speech on the other side in collaboration with the mayor of Tijuana. Very quickly, here's where we are. It was very organized because it was everybody had to have their passport in hand. Here I am crossing one of the most contested trafficked borders in the world under the drain. On the other side of the drain, Mexican immigration was waiting for us to stamp our passports because it was, in fact, an official port of entry for 24 hours while the sewer is flowing from the slum into the estuary. So in a sense, it is this visualization of the kind of conditions of crisis in this case that make me think of public space ultimately, as Chantal Mouffe has suggested, as a battleground where the power of economic and the political power of institutions is simply revealed, visualized, and confronted. So a different conversation across all the stakeholders that produce that crisis is enacted. So this critical kind of curating of the top-down and the bottom-up to enable a different conversation of coexistence and codependence that is a lot more intelligent and less based on this antagonism that has not gotten us anywhere. Let me quickly go through then how this has inspired interventions into public debate itself, and I was invited to come to South Korea to intervene in a public in a project of public art, let's say, loosely speaking, as many of these municipalities invite artists to come and share ideas about this. Here I am in a 20-some floor of a tower in South Korea in the city of Anyang, which is a peripheral city to Seoul. And I'm looking out into the landscape, and I see these small houses that look like the typical Southern California bungalows on the landscape. But when I get close to the window, I realize that these are just the tip ends of what are actually a homogeneous series of slabs, which is really the housing that these governments are building in collaboration with developers. And then I realized right away that this sort of crisis or conflict between those new projects, which are called new towns, and the destruction of the older neighborhoods, which have been on the ground, which are more of a kind of horizontal density, was the project. Because they were going to demolish this neighborhood in order to build this new project. So immediately I realized that the project I wanted to engage was the conflict between the vertical and the horizontal, which I think we have not been able to inventively and creatively resolve. And decided to build models with communities, with activists, with students, with children, and engineering students, of the five neighborhoods that were going to be slated for demolition in the next 5 years in this city. So we went to the streets literally to build these physical models. We wanted to make them really lyrical, and we didn't work with architectural students because, you know, they were proposing to do these basswood models that were very abstract. I wanted to make them extremely realistic to understand the kind of conditions on the ground a lot more, again, anecdotally. So models as mediating tools that could really reorganize the conversation. So here we really, this project took 8 months working with these different communities and taking the models across the city to use them as devices, almost as excuses for producing a different conversation. And as we were moving across the city, we were also documenting a variety of spaces that were incredibly fantastic. That were also enabling visualizations that were very, very funny but very provocative, because this is where we said, you know, some of the activists, this is what happens to these environments from one day to another, bulldozers come and these things emerge. That took us to a series of environments that were really fantastical, such as this project that this man produced in 5 rooftops of this neighborhood. He developed a snail farm, but also he organized his block into a cooperative. So this sort of associative fabric of activism in these environments are always demolished and erased once the new projects emerge. In a variety of, again, informal economies and informal organizational logics that were ultimately being ignored. So it is here where this notion of the operative dimension of community or participation really came to mind. Not the symbolic way that we think of community, but the operative processes that are embedded in communities. And so as we were moving the models to the city, taking them to the designers of the towers, taking them to the office of the mayor, literally the project became a conversation, again, on coexistence, as we were trying to really narrativize those spaces. What we found out is that the communities themselves in many of these neighborhoods did not have the language to really claim the importance of these spaces, the social spaces and the informal economies. So immediately it's a kind of crisis, as I was saying, of knowledge in seeking a new political language that could really make a case for the performance of these environments as devices that can rethink logics of development of housing. And the intervention ultimately then becomes one of intervening into the debate. And finally, just to set up the discussion quickly, is that, of course, this has inspired us to collaborate not only with Penn Design, with PEC here in Philadelphia, with Slot Foundation, to produce, again, a model of urban pedagogical importance, in a sense. So this has been a collaboration that began a couple of years ago in preparation of this project, where these environments that are very close to each other but at times very distant in the relationship really can come together, so that we produced literally a collaboration across these different institutions. And we thought, could we begin a project that would enable the circulation of youth from the neighborhood to the university to the gallery throughout a year? So we would shape a curriculum for a whole year. It's very complex, and I do not attempt to really tell you the whole story because it's been really a huge process. But nevertheless, we've been interested in the designing of the interfaces, the kind of pedagogical logic of this process, from how we are going to engage some of these amazing teens that or these youth that have been collaborating with us. How do we ultimately enable the critical engagement of issues, of tools and media to produce projects with them. There has been a process by which a menu of opportunities or conditions are really visualized. In the summer, the teams began this project where they were to construct narratives based on particular conditions of conflict or crisis or opportunity, but also linking them to particular media or medium in order to produce projects. The point has been, in essence, that we have produced a curriculum for 1 year. Began in the summer, where the 10 youth began to construct narratives of their neighborhood. And now this, in the fall, the narratives come to Penn Design, where the narratives will attempt to infiltrate themselves into the alteration of particular conventions of representation, whether it's from planning or beyond. So we're interested in the tweaking and the alteration of existing protocols, or pedagogical protocols. And in the spring, the group will arrive to SLOT, where that visualization will produce what we hope is a very new model of exhibition and archiving, let's say. So the idea is how the youth, who are the only constants in this circulation of knowledge, really move across the institutions and ultimately challenge the very protocols that have been sheltered within these institutions. I think the need to rethink pedagogical models through activism, which at times are at odds. I mean, the pedagogical models in universities are at odds with the extracurricular and the more organic kind of procedures that activism on the ground really enacts. And we began with the production of a table, the urban table that has been talked about. It's a huge table that if you come to the reception tonight, you will see literally the map of Philadelphia that that really is of this vicinity, but the opportunity of twisting it so that maybe the river becomes the shore and to reorganize the conversation at times. The youth in the summer constructed the table itself, was the first act. So that this artifact, similar to the models in Korea, became an excuse to organize the community and the conversation, and the table was deployed in the space, and from there we began to the series of, procedures. Let me finish with these two images, if I can move the next one, because it would be too great to name everybody who has been involved in this. But I wanted to finish with a voice. I know that Ajua is here from the group. Where are you? Yes, she's here. And I don't know if Duane and Kishan, I don't think they came. But let me finish with their voices very quickly, because part of the process was to record everybody's voices. The youth, the coordinators, the floating faculty, as the first gesture of the project was to produce what we call a social contract, where everybody would voice a condition of concern and a kind of accountability that everybody would be kind of bounded by. And these are the two clips from Duane and from Kishan as an example.
The problem in our youth today is that we're so accustomed to hear what we want to hear, and we're so afraid to hear what we need to hear. And I think this program will put us, that'll help us with life. I think Mixed Place should be another space to come to get an education outside of school, deal with topics that maybe schools won't cover. They have taken a lot of topics I think we need out of schools. Like, we don't talk about jobs, social relations. You don't talk about the pressures that are in this world and how you can overcome them.
They are 16 years old.
One of the social issues in my neighborhood is people go by what people look like versus what they really have to offer or bring to the table. Most people don't know if other people have the same kind of interests as them. They just go by where you're from and what you look like instead of what's inside.
And this semester, we are working with a group of graduate students here who are volunteering their time to receive and host the teens and the youth into the university. So the process continues. Thank you very much.